All right. So today's show is about sucking up and sycophancy, which are both the same things and maybe slightly different conditions of the same thing. I can tell you that the minute we knew that there was a new book out called Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy, we knew we wanted to do – we hadn't even read the book, and we knew we probably wanted to do the show. And then we read the book, which is written by Deborah Parker and Mark Parker, and we discovered it's exactly the kind of thing that we like, too, in the sense that it, in terms of the examples it draws from, it is reliant on both high culture – which is to say Proust, et cetera, and Greek philosophers, and kind of low to middle culture. I mean, it's got Tolkien, you know. So we thought, oh, we're all set. So let me tell you a couple of things before we get going with the Parkers. And let me tell you also that in the final segment, we were sort of thinking about, you know, people who maybe institutionally have to suck up to a certain degree. We started thinking about butlers. And so we are going to talk to a butler and a person who not only has been a butler, but trains butlers in the final segment of the show today, talking about threading that particular needle. But that's going to be preceded by an overview. Before I get to that, I have to tell you that today, I want to tell you that today is one of the shows that we call Radio for the Deaf, which is to say that we have tried to create a radio medium which can be enjoyed and experienced by the deaf community. The way we do this is we have two fabulous, and I'm not just sucking up, interpreters here in the studio with me. They will be interpreting the show into American Sign Language. The visual version of that will be available to you on the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page. So go to our show Facebook page and you should see the video of our two interpreters doing this. If you know anybody in the deaf community who basically has no access to radio, please tell them about this. We try to do it every two Thursdays. We might have to violate that in December. But anyway, so that's that. Now, why talk about sycophancy right now? Well, you could argue that we're in a golden age of sycophancy. And I'm going to begin by playing for you a tape that is newly renewed and renewedly, I guess, in the news. This is the famous Access Hollywood tape, not part of the Access Hollywood show, but the back and forth between Billy Bush and Donald Trump, who, as you listen to this, remember, at this point, he's a businessman and a little bit of a celebrity, but he's not a politician or the president of the United States. So you'll probably hear the more famous part of this audio, and then I'm going to contextualize it a little bit more. So here it goes.
Whoa.
Yes.
Whoa.
Yes, the Donald has scored.
Whoa.
Oh, my man. Wait, you got to look at me when you get out of your
life. Sets this up.
That is very
will you give me the thumbs
look
up?
Look at you. You are a
you got to put the thumbs up. You got to get the thumbs up.
Can't be too happy. Else off first?
Yeah, let me.
It's very fun.
You got to give me the thumbs up.
You and I will walk there.
Oh, my God.
Maybe it's a different one.
Better not be the publicist. No, it's her.
Yeah, that's her, with the gold. I better use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the pussy. You can do anything.
So we know which part of that tape has become avowedly anyway important in terms of our understanding of who this man is. But now I want to call your attention to Billy Bush in this tape, who is the ultimate lickspittle. As they're driving, this bus is kind of coming onto the lot, and they see the woman with whom Donald is going to be paired up. And I'm calling him Donald, geez. The Trump is going to be paired up. And you hear Bush go, the Donald has scored. And what you don't hear here, it happens a little bit later when they get off the bus and they meet this attractive woman in a purple dress. She greets them and meets them. And then Billy Bush goes, how about a hug for the Donald? So she gives him a hug and a kiss or whatever. And then they're walking along. And Billy Bush says something to the effect that, you know, I can barely even walk next to this man. No woman will ever notice me, that kind of thing. So you're really seeing the toady, the lickspittle, the sycophant in his full flower. And it's, I think, probably pretty characteristic of the way Donald Trump was treated during his time as a businessman. Now, during his time in office, have people started being a little bit more clear and direct with him? We don't think so. Let's listen to a little bit of audio from the 10-day era of Scaramucci.
The president has a very unique communication style
I would argue, people will say that I'm being sycophantic. I'm not. I'm just being objective. He is arguably the most media savvy person in history, but certainly of our times.
So now it's time for you to meet Deborah Parker and Mike Parker. Deborah Parker, professor of Italian at the University of Virginia, co-author with, as I say, Mark Parker, who is professor of English at James Madison University. And this book, once again, is called Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. So Deborah Parker, you know, it could be argued listening to this and maybe some other audio that we'll hear as we go along that we are in a golden age of sycophancy. But on the other hand, this whole question has been tackled as early as Plutarch, right? So this is something that people have been thinking about for a long time. Is there anything different about the present moment?
Yes, it's become far more public. And at times, the comments that people are making are rather bland. There's no real artfulness in the way they're speaking. The tape you just played of Anthony Scaramucci, he's very blatant about saying how great the president is. And in another interview, he said, I love the president no less than five times. It's become very public. Before, there are three players usually. There's the target, there's the ingratiator, and often there are observers. He's playing to the observer, and especially one observer in particular.
Right. And you know, Plutarch, Mark, asks the question, is anything harmed by this? And he says, well, first of all, the person whose own credentials are being distorted is harmed, and probably the person who is adopting this very false self system as an ingratiator is harmed. But he makes the argument, I think, that the community is harmed too in a much more finely grained way. And I think now we would agree, right?
I think so. I think it's pretty clear that we're all sort of suffering from that kind of harm as the community becomes a place where we really can't tell what's true and what's false. And sometimes we see that people involved in this don't really care about the difference between true and false.
There's so much to say about that, but I just want to continue on for a second. Well, Mark, let's just stay with this for a second, because political sycophancy within the White House is nothing new. At one point, JFK identifies this as a problem, one of the things that may have distorted his judgment about the Bay of Pigs, and actually asks his brother Bobby to be kind of the non-sycophant in the room, the person who challenges him when everybody else is nodding their head. You write a lot about Kissinger, who in a very artful way would get his way, much like Disraeli, whom you also write a lot about, by being a very effective and conscious sycophant. Is this different from the thing that you're describing about 2017?
I think that's very hard to say whether there's more or less sycophancy in the political realm now and in years past. My guess is that it's much the same. I think there's one essential difference, that it's more public. And that expectation now is that people go public with their sycophancy. I think when Kissinger and some of the advisors for JFK were doing their sycophancy, it was often behind closed doors. And it came out later, much to their chagrin, but many, many years later. Now it's supposed to be, you're looking directly at the camera. There was a wonderful clip of Scaramucci one time really looking right at the camera and talking to the Donald through social media. That really is a change.
Well, so Deborah, I think maybe it's a philosophical question, and maybe it's more than that. But you could be argued that sycophant is a more or less permanent condition. Sucking up is a tool that people pick up and put down as they need it. Most of us at some point over the course of any given week might lavish a little bit of not entirely genuine praise on somebody else because the occasion calls for it. Even Disraeli is very He knows and you know, in a very lively way, acknowledges to other people that his job simply involves troweling praise onto Queen Victoria, but he seems to see it as a technique rather than an identity. Is that a useful distinction, that sucking up is temporary, sycophancy is more permanent?
I'm not sure, but there certainly is a difference between being nice and kind to one's friends or coworkers, pointing out, oh, what a nice color you're wearing, or something like that, and being an inveterate, habitual suck-up, someone who is very opportunistic, thinking about strategies that would enhance his or her own position. That is, there's, I think, quite a difference between just normal everyday kindness and inveterate sucking up.
Right. Well, Deborah, also, I think that, you know, in a way, we have to kind of come up with a taxonomy or a morphology a little bit for this, because I do think the more that I read your book, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, it's interesting to think anyway about the direction in which these things flow. So who is it who needs this? You know, before we came officially on the air, I was talking before the news about Eddie Haskell, who was the friend of Wally Cleaver on Leave It to Beaver. You guys may be too young to remember any of this, but he kind of famously would begin his encounters with Wally's mom by, "That's a lovely dress you're wearing today, Mrs. Cleaver," and that would go on. And it was clear to the audience that Mrs. Cleaver didn't need this, and she didn't buy it. She didn't need to be told she had a lovely dress on. Eddie needed to be that person at that moment in order to conceal the rascal that he was. And so I think as we look, Deborah, at some of these transactions, they're all a little bit different. Sometimes it's the object of the flattery who needs the flattery. Sometimes it's the flatterer who needs it in order to advance his or her position. And I guess sometimes it's both.
Yes, that's very true. Hierarchies enable flattery, and it depends on who's really at the top, who's the boss, the director, the president, whatever. If this person craves flattery, as say Trump does or other leaders, then then the entire community tends to participate and enable that, either agreeing with him or enhancing his opinions, not calling out, not pointing out disagreements, activity like that.
So, Mark, through the book, you talk about a series of upsuckers, some of whom we are familiar with and others of whom maybe we're not. You know, Uriah Heep and David Copperfield, we maybe know. Le Grandin, who's in Swan's Way, in Proust's Remembrances of Things Past, maybe people don't know as well. Lear's daughters, Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings. Now, all of those people are false people. In other words, Uriah Heep is ultimately a harmful person pretending to be humble. You know, Le Grandin is a snob who, under certain circumstances, will turn into drop his arrogance and turn into a suck-up to the shock of observers who think they know him. Lear's daughters are in it for themselves. Wormtongue is trying to weaken the king of Rohan for his own nefarious purposes. But, you know, there are other suck-ups who are different. I mean, one of the people that we can't avoid is Smithers, the sycophant to Mr. Burns in The Simpsons, who, like the Tony Hale character in Veep, Gary, is genuinely entranced and enamored with the person he is worshiping. So is that different?
Well, there is a real difference there, I think. And in part, what people think about sucking up or sycophancy has changed over time. If you look back further in time and in history, there's a sense of real moral opprobrium involved in this, and it's just absolute. And I think you can see that in the way popular culture has come up with such wonderful names for sucking up: bootlicker, lick spittle, toad eater, brown noser, a kisser, kiss a, suck up. These are terms that sort of suggest a kind of opprobrium, a kind of contempt for this kind of action. I think over time, it's become a little more transactional, and it's become something of an ethics-free zone as people think about it as an activity they can begin and do it for a certain purpose strategically, and then step back and be free of in some ways. They're washed clean of it. I don't think it was quite so easy over in the past to sort of walk away from this and simply say it was a transaction that is now over.
There's another example of someone who gets away with it, too, and that would be every one of Jane Austen's novels has a flatterer sycophant. But in thinking about her novels, the one we decided to focus on is Lucy Steele in Sense and Sensibility. This is the novel that Ang Lee turned into a beautiful film. And the novel has two protagonists, two sisters. And Lucy comes from a different class, not as refined as the two Dashwood sisters. Nevertheless, she worms her way into a friendship with Eleanor Dashwood and into their circle, endlessly flattering the ill-behaved children of one of the women. And at the very end of the novel, Jane Austen has something pretty revealing to say about Lucy. And it's that she just says that Lucy represents a most encouraging instance of what an earnest and unceasing attention to self-interest, however its progress may be apparently obstructed, will do in securing every advantage of fortune with no other sacrifice than of time and conscience. So that's all you lose in pursuing your self-interest, time and conscience. But when one thinks about it, that's losing a lot.
That is losing a lot. Although, Mark, I, one of the things that I find myself thinking about are people who make up the entourages of famous people, whether they're famous athletes or movie stars or rappers or whatever. And in many cases, the people in those entourages, these coteries, these posses, you know, they I think I probably know it best in the world of professional athletes. Many of these people are people with very little else, at least as far as they can imagine, to trade, right? They're not as good an athlete as Wilt Chamberlain, so they have attached themselves to his entourage, and they repeat the things that he says with more emphasis. They laugh at his jokes. They make him comfortable. And in a way, ultimately, what they're doing is maybe similar to what Austin's describing. They have decided that if they trade that part of themselves, they can achieve a degree of comfort for a while.
Yeah. One of the things that drew us to this whole consideration of sycophancy was how complicated it was. I mean, if you just sort of set it out in terms of like the taxonomy you were sort of talking about earlier, a single act of ingratiation can mean one thing to the actor, to the person who sucks it up, a completely different thing to the target, and still another thing to the observer. So those are three sort of ways of looking at the same act. And that in its also is also complicated by the fact that sycophants are often unaware of their sycophancy. That really puts this in a kind of a complex place almost immediately, because there are so many different possibilities from a single act in terms of interpreting it, in terms of thinking about it, and certainly in terms of justifying it to oneself.
I was also thinking about what you were saying about the entourages, and they have in some cases contributed to the financial downfall of famous figures. MC Hammer and Prince both surrounded themselves with masses of people, and one imagines that they attained a kind of reflected glory in being part of these entourages, but in maintaining them, the Prince and MC Hammer beggared themselves.
Right. And Deborah, I think that's something we see in literature, too. OK, so you've just described a kind of a real life way in which the person who sits on top of that heap, and I don't mean Uriah Heep, the person who sits on top of that pile of flatterers can never see clearly, can never be completely well. So with the other Heap, with Uriah Heep, he's a boil that ultimately has to be lanced for the world of David Copperfield to be healthy. Somehow or other, he has to be exposed as the fraud that he is. And similarly, in Lord of the Rings, you know, the king can't be healthy until the spell of Wormtongue has been cast off. For people who don't know this book or movie, Wormtongue is this guy who whispers into the ear of the king of Rohan and gradually weakens him. And Deborah, I think that's a very implicit symbol system there. What Tolkien is saying is that kind of person will ultimately make you far, far worse and less effective than you would otherwise be.
Yeah, in the case of Wormtongue, he really has insinuated himself into the into being a very close, intimate, a kind of courtier of the King of Rohan, who himself is not a weak ruler. It's just the power of the flatterer that has overtaken him. And Tolkien seems to think that, at least in Middle Earth, it takes nothing less than a wizard to drive out Wormtongue from the kingdom.
I'll tell you what we're going to do right now. I want to talk about this in the next segment, particularly sort of in terms of management. There's a student of the psychology of management, Edward Jones, with whom you deal a lot in the book. I think we can also circle back a little bit to the Trump administration in that way as well. So let's take a little break. We're talking about sucking up here in the afternoon or whenever you're listening to us, and we will be back after this. Don't cry, oh, limousines and sycophants. Don't leave me now, cause I'm afraid what you've done to me is now the warmth in my bed.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, we've just heard from that great sycophant of billionaires, the leader of the opposition. All the lectures he's trying to run a politics of envy. When he was a regular dinner guest at Raheen, always there with Dick Pratt, sucking up to Dick Pratt. Did he knock back the Cristal? I don't think so. There was never a union leader in Melbourne that tucked his knees under more billionaires' tables than the Leader of the Opposition. He lapped it up. Oh, yes, he lapped it up.
Members on my
he
right.
Was such a sycophant, a social-climbing sycophant, if ever there was one. There has never been a more sycophantic leader of the Labor Party than this one. And he comes here and poses as a tribune of the people. He, like Harbourside Mansions, he's yearning for one. He's yearning to get into Kirribilli House. You know why? Because somebody else pays for it.
That is Malcolm Turnbull, the Prime Minister of Australia. That's their parliament. He's denouncing a Labor leader and using all of the key words in the title of Mark and Deborah Parker's book, sucking up a brief consideration of sycophancy. And they are still with us, and there's a lot to talk about. But Deborah, I think we need to talk a little bit about how this is understood in the world of business and in the world of management, because once again, there may be a place for a certain kind of self-presentation that includes blandishments. I don't know how to call it, but maybe you can sort of help us understand this. And I know you're relying a lot also on the management theory and psychology theories of Edward Jones. So what do we learn when we transfer this whole question into the world of business?
Well, there is an enormous transformation, whereas Jones was really looking at the phenomenon and trying to understand it and identifying just how difficult it is often to determine the intent of the ingratiator. The literature in business schools has taken a completely different direction. And rather than using the more derogatory terms like brown noser, butt kisser, lick spittle, toad eater, they have coined this wonderful term, and it's sanitized what is involved in flattery, and it's IM, ingratiation management. And they're recommending how people can have to hone their political skills in order to size up their bosses so that they can leverage their ingratiation in order to further their careers. They wonder whether they are teaching students adequately to become good suck-ups. It's a very different world of in terms of taking it very much for granted. Mark might have more to say about this because this was a section of the book he addressed more than I did.
Yeah, Mark,
go ahead. When we started thinking about this, we really wanted to use literary texts for the most part because we were interested in some of the mysterious aspects of this interpersonal transaction. And part of our argument was that literature allows, through the empathetic reading response, you can get inside the head of the suck-up or the person who's being sucked up to. But that led us immediately to think about what are psychologists doing with this. And we did run across this wonderful book by Jones, which is thoroughly imbued with a kind of broad humanistic approach. He despises this. He is interested in it. It just goes without saying throughout his book that this is a bad idea. But he's also very good at sort of making what you call the taxonomy and talking about the method of thinking about this. What was also surprising was to see how this migrated from psychology departments, this kind of research, to departments in business school. And as Deborah was saying, it really changed in its focus. Instead of like, what is it? It was more how to do it well. And the question was just how to maximize it and how to. There's one quote that I really treasure that I found in reading these business school accounts. How do you leverage the ingratiation influence resource? the idea of leveraging it, something that traditionally was a moral failing, is really a shock.
Well, I think this is a slightly different sphere, too. We could certainly argue, along with Plutarch, that people who do this maybe ultimately lead their superiors into folly, you know, and it might be folly that damages the common weal, too, if we lead our superior, we flatter our superiors into the point where they can't see that they're making a really terrible and maybe even life and death terrible decision about a product like Tylenol or something. I don't know. That wasn't really the fault of the CEO. I'm trying to think of a really good example of this. But, you know, obviously the world of business is full of people, full of executives who have failed to come realistically to grips with a problem with their airbags or whatever, and if they don't have a clear vision of themselves, Mark, it seems to me because their lackeys have been following this notion of ingratiation management, there maybe is a damage to the rest of us.
Yes, that's one of the central things we really were surprised to see is how clearly set out this was in the past. Plutarch really understands the dangers, and Deborah may speak to this later, but the person who really understands the dangers of this is Dante, who really kind of has a real master class in thinking about what sycophancy is, what it's connected to, what other kinds of behaviors it's connected to, and how damaging it is to the larger cultural order.
Yeah, I can say a little bit about that. There are 9 circles to Dante's Inferno, and flatterers are punished in the 8th circle, along with other despicable sins. What really surprises many of my students is that murderers are punished in the 7th circle. And it's very difficult for many readers to think of anything worse than murder. But Dante places sins like flattery below that of the 7th circle of murderers. And along with flatterers, he has liars, sowers of discord, hypocrites, thieves. He sees these sins as interconnected. And for Dante, something like flattery and lying, hypocrisy, these are sins against the community. Because if you're flattering someone endlessly, it makes frank communication impossible. And the loss of that is a sin against the community.
Right. And Dante is probably borrowing just a little bit on Jesus, who also, in his denunciation of lawyers and Pharisees and stuff like that, is also, I think, making essentially the same point.
Yes.
So and I'm sure Dante would be happy to give a nod to Jesus on that one. So I think one of the things, so we have somebody from the world of business, Donald Trump, who clearly his business mode has been to insist on this kind of unflinching loyalty that includes an unquestioning loyalty and that, you know, how you show your loyalty to him does include, to a certain degree, that kind of flattery that we heard at the beginning of the show. We were treated to what I found kind of a disturbing and humiliating circus of this early on in his presidency with his cabinet. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Thank you, Mr. President, and just the greatest privilege of my life is to serve as vice president to a president who's keeping his word to the American people.
With your direction, we were able to also focus on the forgotten man and woman who are the folks who are paying those taxes. So I appreciate your support and your direction in pulling that budget together.
President, what an incredible honor it is to lead the Department of Health and Human Services at this pivotal time under your leadership. I can't thank you enough for the privilege that you've given me and the leadership that you've shown.
Rex? Mr. President, thank you for the honor to serve the country. It's a great privilege you've given me.
On behalf of the entire senior staff around you, Mr. President, we thank you for the opportunity and the blessing that you've given us to serve your agenda and the American people, and we're continuing to work very hard every day to accomplish those goals.
So, Mark, what are we to make of this pageant here? I mean, these are some of the highest-ranking members of the cabinet who have been asked in a very public way to engage in ingratiation management, whether they took the course or not.
Right. That was staggering. I mean, I don't think anybody expected that kind of obviousness to this. I think we can assume that things like this went on, maybe not going around the table, but it was, again, it was private. this is public and it's really for the cameras and it's really for that larger sort of sphere of the observer. I mean, Trump seems to want this kind of activity and he seems to elicit it, but he also wants it to be seen by everyone. It's not enough just to kiss the ring in private for him. It really has to be done on as many media platforms as possible.
And Deborah, we are told that in his encounters with James Comey, he asked for a vow of loyalty. Comey offered him honesty. Trump, ever making deals, countered with, well, how about honest loyalty? We have Jeff Flake in his resignation speech talking about how a section of his party will stop at nothing less than anything short of complete and unquestioning loyalty. But, you know, this kind of distorts the notion of loyalty, because it could be argued that if you have loyalty to the king, to the CEO, to the president, one thing you will do is tell him when he's, you know, got the pedal to the metal and he's driving the car into a concrete wall. But you can't do that if flattery is the coin of the realm.
Yes, you've put it very well. We've all seen what happened to Comey and also to Sally Ann Yates, who was the acting attorney general. Both of them have been kicked out because they were not sufficiently loyal to Trump. And with him, it's not just enough to be one begins with simply confirming his views, but better still if you can turn yourself into some kind of human Photoshop app and enhance everything he says, no matter how fallacious.
So as we're heading towards this segment we're going to do about butlers, Mark, I'll end this part of the conversation by asking a little bit about how you read Ishiguro's novel, The Remains of the Day, made into the movie with Anthony Hopkins as this butler, Stevens, this guy who he has an incredible loyalty to his master, who's this deeply flawed man with fascistic leanings. But he also, I think, maybe has a loyalty to the institution that he represents, the loyalty of to the idea of being a butler. Is that part of what makes him unable to see his own master clearly?
Yeah, that text is very interesting because I'm not sure it's so much about butlers, but it really does show a great deal about sycophancy because there's a couple of key things here. First of all, as a butler, he really doesn't seem to understand what he's doing. And he hides it from himself. And this goes back to that idea that some sycophants never really see their sycophancy. It goes back to Proust, who talked about what he called the intervening effects of the imagination, that the sycophant creates someone to follow who is better than the person they're following. And this justifies actually what they're doing. That's a kind of a master class in sort of the lack of knowledge of self and also in the kind of interesting ability of sycophants to make over the world for themselves. If you think about it, there's an irony here. Sycophants often are changing the nature of the world for the target, lying to them, making them think they're better than they are. The world is different from it is. But they also lie to themselves and are in justifying their activity. So there's a kind of double sort of blindness that's being imposed by sycophancy.
Right. There's a way in which some sycophants, Stevens, the butler in this book, and Smithers in The Simpsons, they're prisoners of their sycophancy. They can't get free of it. Whereas Disraeli, as you show him to us, is sort of the opposite, right? I mean, the fact that he has decided, well, when necessary, and given the fact that I'm in this weird artificial institution that involves a queen, you know, I will be a sycophant. And that will actually kind of set me free in a way, right?
Yeah, they're both willing players in this game. It's almost as though we can look at the relationship between Disraeli and Queen Victoria as a kind of mask in which he repeatedly refers to her as a fairy, thinking of Spencer's fairy queen, and she responds in kind. He had said famously to the poet Matthew Arnold that everybody loves flattery. I've been told I'm a flattery. Everyone loves flattery. And with royalty, you have to lay it on with a trowel. And what really separates someone like Disraeli from more run-of-the-mill figures like Kissinger and others we've discussed so far on the show is his artfulness. He was a great writer as well. He began, in fact, as a novelist. And he capitalizes on these resources of language in writing Queen Victoria, these wonderful notes, transforming her into this fairy or some other mythical figure. And there's something really admirable more in looking at his artfulness. And they did one another favors as well, and he did get many of the things he wanted as prime minister, but it's on a very different level than others we've discussed.
We have to stop there. We've been talking to Mark Parker, professor of English at James Madison University, Deborah Parker, a professor of Italian at the University of Virginia. I wish I could talk to you more. I'm heading off to Lucca tomorrow night. But right now, the subject has been the book Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. In the final segment today, we will be talking to a butler. I also want to remind you that we're doing Radio for the Deaf with our wonderful interpreters. I'm not just sucking up to them. You can find them on the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page, where they're offering this show interpreted in American Sign Language. All right, let's take that break. And when we come back, you'll meet a butler.
And frankly, Mike's right about him being right. Not only that, but you remember my great idea that Mike had last week?
I don't know about anybody else, but I think Colin is doing such a fantastic job here. Today's show is produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish is not just a good fish, she's a great fish. Our intern is Sarah Bly. The part of Bill Curry was played by Eddie Haskell. Tonight, The Nose goes live at 8 p.m. with a conversation about three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. That's a movie. They're not discussing actual billboards. And that same show airs again at 1 p.m. on Friday. And now, back to Colin.
We're speaking to Stephen Ferry, chairman of the International Institute of Modern Butlers, the author of three textbooks, including The British Butler's Bible. Welcome to this conversation, sir.
Thank you, Mr. McEnroe.
So let's begin with the question, why do people want butlers as opposed to, I mean, there are ways to get certain tasks accomplished using different kinds of personnel. What's the special need that a butler is meeting?
He's really managing the house. He's CEO Home Inc. Someone who's really wealthy probably has someone managing his one or more companies. So why not also his one or more residences?
And so one of the other notions that we have of a butler is that a butler has to create, I guess, almost kind of a persona for dealing with his duties. For me, anyway, the thing that's kind of locked in my mind is Jeeves and Bertie Wooster, where Jeeves obviously is smarter than Bertie, but he can't really ever let Bertie know that there's a way in which you have to be superb at your job without seeming to be better than the person who's employing you. I'm assuming some of that is locked in the past and not necessarily germane to today's butler.
Exactly, because not all employers are as, frankly, daffy as Worcester is today. In fact, it goes back a long time. If you talk about history, the Greek plays used to have a figure who was like a butler, but he was very much trying to find ways of benefiting from the relationship, often in a dishonest way. Obviously, we try not to carry that through today because that's not appreciated by people, but If you look at the function of the butler, he is close to the employer. He could take advantage of him, such as, Blackadder with Prince Edward. I don't know if you've seen that series. He constantly takes advantage of his employer. But generally speaking, employers are not stupid, and they appreciate good service and caring service.
Another notion that we have, I think, from that idea, our cultural image of the butler is one of almost self-sacrifice. And even if you think of Downton Abbey, Carson is, in a way, maybe locked in an older idea of what his job is compared to some of the younger staff who tend to see the world in terms of at least some obligations to them, things that maybe they could reasonably expect for themselves. And Carson spends a lot of time kind of telling them what their place is. And there's a sense that he is prepared anyway to sacrifice a tremendous amount of himself for his employer. We see that also, I think, in Remains of the Day, which I know that you've written about. In fact, are we going to play a clip here from Remains of the Day? Why don't we just play that clip right now?
Good. Stevens. Yes, ma'am. We have some refugee girls on the staff at the moment, I believe.
We do, my lord. Two housemaids, us and Emma.
You'll have to let them go, I'm afraid.
Let them go, my lord.
It's regrettable, Stevens, but we have no choice. You've got to see the whole thing in context. I have the well-being of my guests to consider.
My lord, may I say, they work extremely well. They're intelligent, polite, and very clean.
I'm sorry, Stevens, but I've looked into this matter very carefully. There are larger issues at stake. I'm sorry, but there it is. They're Jews. Yes, my lord. Thank you.
Now, that's, of course, Anthony Hopkins in the role of Stevens in Ishiguro's novel. My recollection is that it's almost like peeling off layers of onion skin, you know, that Stevens, because of his almost blind loyalty to his employer, can't even really see for a long time, and therefore cannot really tell us, the readers, how morally flawed his employer is. But once again, I feel like that's a novelist's and then a filmmaker's notion of what a butler is. Do you recognize any of the butler's job in that depiction?
Absolutely. It was actually quite amazing that Steves would have queried his employer three times. Mm-hmm. Normally, he would just say, "Certainly, sir," the first request. But obviously, he does have an issue with this, and it's quite a very touching piece. That, but you are expected to do what your boss wants. But if you really have a serious issue with it, then you don't have to go along with it, and you could even resign. No one today is really forced to stay in their position. But you do have to stay loyal to yourself as well as to your employer. If you start compromising your own moral code, then it's a very slippery slope. And we can see where that ended up Stevens by the end of the novel or the end of the movie. I've seen that movie about 100 times. I think it's the best one ever made. We can see that he recognizes that he might have made a mistake possibly in being so blindly loyal to his employer. But blind loyalty isn't part of the job requirement, but loyalty is. Intelligent loyalty, perhaps, today.
And so today, I want you to give us also a sense of what a butler does today, what a day in the life of a butler is. I think now, you know, those of us who give any thought to this at all think that instead of addressing a butler, people are addressing Siri or various technological equivalents and setting up technology and electronics to anticipate our needs. But I'm assuming that the butler still has a certain human touch.
Yes, and the human touch is invaluable because you have the element of judgment and nuance, which is very hard to program into a computer. And even when you do program it in, it's not really from the heart, is it? It's from the software. And there's a fundamental difference, which for people who are alive does make a difference. To answer your question, though, mm-hmm. A butler has a wide range of duties, so it really depends what the employer wants. He could be cooking, he could be driving, he could be looking after the house. He could even do the housekeeping if there's nobody else and you're just looking after a single person with not much property. But if you are looking at the traditional butler who's looking after the entire estate and he has lots of staff that he's managing, which is the usual situation, you'd get up quite early in order to open the house and to prepare things for breakfast. You get the staff mustered up and briefed and breakfast is served and then you get your instructions, usually from the employer at that time. Or you coordinate with your employer as to what has been done and what you plan to do. And then you go about and do it. And that includes managing vendors. It includes managing the staff. It could be there's some big party going on that day or in a few days' time that has to be prepared for. You're multitasking, but not necessarily at the same time. That's not very efficient. With the idea that the employer is able to focus, employer and family, on what they'd rather do, and you look after all the dross in running the household. And you keep doing that all day, you'd probably end up serving dinner and clearing up after it, and then closing the house down and then trying to get a few winks.
I know you like that line that Helen Mirren has in Gosford Park. Remind the audience of what she says the greatest quality of a butler is.
Yeah, she asks another visiting staff member, not a guest, what do you think the greatest gift is that a servant has? A servant, we could substitute staff member for today. Mm-hmm. And the lady doesn't know. And she says, well, it's the gift of anticipation. I know when they're hungry and the food is ready. I know when they're tired and the bed is made. Sometimes I know it before they know it themselves. And I think that's just such a beautiful line. It really does hit home. What is the main thing that you're doing as a butler? You're bringing a smile to the employer's face or the guest's face. And that's what brings a smile to your face, ultimately. It's not the paycheck. It's not the bonuses. It's not the astronomic salary sometimes. It's really bringing pleasure to somebody else.
Is the job, to a certain degree, a performance? Is the job, to a certain degree, the acting out of a very specific persona that might diverge somewhat from one's own personality?
You could say that. If the employer insists that you dress up in pink tails and stand stiffly like the old-style butler at the front door and so forth, yes, you are fulfilling a role. But where an employer is more serious about having somebody not just as a symbol but as a functioning member of the team, then absolutely you're not playing a role. But you do have your boundaries, you have your rules and your regulations, but the role is just you doing your job. And it should come from the heart, and it should be you not premeditating what to do, but just naturally doing it. So I wouldn't say that we want to program everybody into being robots. And that's the wrong way to use a butler. Some people obviously do use them as such. The pink tails is something that actually existed in reality.
Well, you know, once again, our cultural depictions of butlers often show them as, yes, having great allegiance to their employers, but also having great allegiance to the certain traditions and the way things are done right. And sometimes subtly, if possible, instructing the employer about that. That's not the way one does things. Pink tails in this situation would not really be appropriate. The notion that the butler sometimes might have to tell the employer that his ideas may not really conform very well to manners or tradition or even the employer's best interests socially.
Right. Well, you really should have answered that question for yourself before taking on the job. You have to find out, is the employer so vacuous and that they would insist on that and then not listen to reason? Now, there's a very, obviously, it's one of the skills of the butler is to be able to handle communications and tricky situations smoothly without embarrassing or upsetting another person. So it is something you could bring up. But if you find yourself stymied by an employer who has a very fixed idea about what a butler should do, and it's not really utilizing you properly, you don't use Rolls Royces to shovel to transport manure. Mm-hmm. So same thing as you don't use a butler in order to do things which anybody could do and not use your skills. So at that point, you should really exit if you find there's too much of this nonsense going on. But by the same token, if a boss wants you to wear pink tails, there's no reason why you shouldn't, as long as he's not making a mockery of you of the position.
Right. I'm told that there is greater demand for butlers these days, not less demand for butlers. To what do you attribute that?
Well, I have to lay it squarely at the hands of the dot-com bubbles and all these other creations of instant wealth over the decades. Before that, butlers had almost disappeared because there wasn't much wealth. Those people who were traditionally wealthy didn't actually have much money left after the First World War and the Second World War. And so butlers were a dwindling or dying species until great wealth started to occur around the world. The next thing you have, once you've got a Rolls Royce or a Bentley or whatever, or a Ferrari, is, well, let's get a butler. After that, what has really expanded it is Downton Abbey, mm-hmm. which has really popularized the concept of butler. There, what you see is a stereotype. The actor himself doesn't like butlers and said he was never employ one, but he does a pretty good job of being a stereotypical butler. There's not much nuance there, but it gives you a very good idea of qualities that people admire and respect and would like to have in their household. So that's been very good for the profession.
Well, I know that given your profession, you're A, a very busy person, and B, keeping your eye on the clock, and we did promise you you'd be done by now. So Stephen Ferry, chairman and international of the International Institute of Modern Butlers, the author of three textbooks, including the British Butler's Bible, has also worked as a butler in the United States. Thank you for sharing your experiences and your expertise with us.
And thank you for your interest.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Dragged down to the lake, Francesca's body in a cake, no pain.